And we're back in the studio in the sky out here on the flight line at EAA Oshkosh AirVenture 2008. And once again, you're listening to EAA Radio on AM 1210, 100.7 FM, and on the web at airventure.org/radio around the world. Okay, who wants to do radio?
Radio.
Oh, look at this. In the studio with us today, we have Lieutenant Colonel John Huggins, Lieutenant Colonel Gary McLeod, Kuma, and also Major John Carbigas, and all are from Beale Air Force Base, from the 9th Reconnaissance Squadron. No, I got it backwards again, didn't I? The 1st Reconnaissance Squadron from the 9th Wing.
Easy to remember, it's the very, very first squadron in the U.S. military.
Exactly, and that's let's talk about that for a moment, because that's the original squadrons were actually reconnaissance squadrons, weren't they?
They were. It goes back to the very, very early 1900s, when aircraft were still brand new. And Pancho Villa was making inruns into the United States from near Columbus, New Mexico, and they finally put together the first Aero Squadron, which is the lineage of our squadron. And I believe it was Black Jack Pershing, I believe, ran the squadron, and they were on missions to do reconnaissance and try to push keep track of Pancho Villa, keep him from invading into the United States.
And then the whole thing changed. I think it came at Crissy Field, as a matter of fact, which was one of the original Army Air Force bases, where the first bombs were dropped as they dropped them over the side of the aircraft, and all of a sudden it went from reconnaissance to aggressor.
Sure. Yep.
And but you still managed to fly the U-2. The worst you can do is scare them with your headlights, right? Let's talk a little bit about the U-2 and the development of it. I know there's probably something on the horizon that the Air Force has out there under development, and if Kelly Johnson were still active in it, I know he'd have something to do with it.
Sure.
But the U-2 has still been able to maintain its mission and its mission readiness over this vast period of time, as is the B-52. But what do you see as the future of the U-2, and what do you expect its lifespan to be?
That's kind of the question of the hour, the million-dollar question. The aircraft, it's really quite simple. The aircraft does something very well. It takes a lot of payload, a lot of reconnaissance equipment, and puts it at a very high altitude and can do it for a long period of time. And it can do it safely and effectively. So to develop another aircraft that can do that after 50-something years, you would think would be an easy thing. It's been very problematic. The U-2 is still the premier air-breathing reconnaissance platform in the world. Now, there's a big push towards unmanned aircraft. There are a number of them out there flying, but none of them are able to come close to the capabilities of the U-2. There are certain niches that each of those fill, and there's certain things that the U-2 can't do, but as an overall reconnaissance platform, it's an amazing aircraft. Over the last 10 years, we've put over $1.5 billion into the aircraft. Earlier, Kuma had alluded to the fact that we did some cockpit upgrades, and they put fiber optics in there. And in addition to the maintenance side, what that did is it cleaned up the signal around the aircraft. Realize that when we're gathering signals, we want to have these very, very fine-tuned pieces of equipment that are listening for these various signals. Well, the aircraft itself puts out a hum, if you will, from all the electronics going off. So by cleaning up our own noise pollution around the aircraft, if you will, we made it so the sensors can really, really hear things now that are even more faint. So just all these little things we've been doing over the last 10 years have really made the aircraft a super effective platform. And quite frankly, I think it's going to be a little while, at least a decade and a half before somebody can actually get an aircraft out there that'll be able to compete against us.
Major Cavadas, I know that again in the training regimen, part of this is operating the equipment that is aboard, the very, very sensitive equipment and the array of equipment. You're covering both visual and, of course, electronic monitoring at the same time. How much of a learning curve is involved in that for the pilot of the U-2, being it is a one-man ship?
Well, it really, after we go through what we call our BQ, our basic qualification stage, we send them through a mission qualification stage. Initially, we'll teach them in the BQ phase, which is roughly 14 sorties, to first land the aircraft, because it is the most difficult airplane in the inventory to land, by virtue of its landing gear configuration, really, and its wingspan and so forth. So once we get them through that and flying high, and then flying high solo, we'll graduate them into the mission qualification stage, where we actually teach them about sensors, employment, and maneuvers, and other types of things that they can do, evasive maneuvers as well as threats, how to counter threats, and things of that nature. So it's quite actually a long program. In the past, we've joked around that it's a three-month program crammed into 6 months. But really, it takes quite a bit of time to teach somebody how to manage everything, manage all the equipment on board as well, because each piece of equipment has its nuances and its capabilities that you have to know and understand. Really, most people think that U2 is still just a Gary Powers wet film framing camera, like a 35 millimeter camera type thing. But really, we do not have that anymore. We do carry a wet film camera still. We can carry that. But really, most of the things that we do now is much more digital.
Just as we wind up for this morning, I know one of the things it alluded to was the handling capability of the aircraft and being able to land it properly. And Lieutenant Gary McLeod, or Lieutenant Colonel Gary McLeod, talk about the unique combination that it takes to fly this airplane. It takes the skills of a fighter pilot. It also takes the skills of an advanced aerobatic pilot in a high-powered tail dragger.
Absolutely. The aircraft itself has got a very small operating envelope when it's down here in the very thick air. Handles very crisply and cleanly, like an airplane should when we're up 70,000 feet or more. But down here where it's thick, it wallows and it leads and it lags, and it's a real handful. And couple that with the fact that what we want to do is we want to achieve a full stall on the aircraft while it's still in the air. And obviously, if we stalled the aircraft too high, we'll break the aircraft. And if we don't stall it, then we won't get the tailwheel fully on the ground. And anybody that has flown a tail dragger knows you need the tailwheel on the ground for controllability. So we really only have about a knot or two difference between a good landing and a bad landing of airspeed control. And then altitude control is only about a foot or so. We want to stall the aircraft from 2 feet. But if we stall it from 3 or possibly 4 feet, then we risk serious damage to the mission equipment.
A very, very complex set of requirements required to fly successfully the U-2. And ladies and gentlemen, here on EAA Radio, you've been listening to Lieutenant Colonel Gary McLeod, Lieutenant Colonel John Huggins, and Major John Cabagas, and they're from Beale Air Force Base in California. You'll find their U-2 out there on the West Ramp on Aeroshell Square. Stop by and say hi. A great crew. Thank you very much indeed, gentlemen.
Thank you,
Gordon. Thank you.
And you've been listening to EAA Radio, AM 1210, 100.7 FM, and on the web at airventure.org/radio.